This program brought to you by Vanderbilt University. You can find more audio and video on our website, vanderbilt.edu/news.
Welcome to Like a Prayer, a series of public events on popular music and religious identity. This is the October 14th session in which we are really pleased to have with us Bill Friscus Warren. This event is sponsored by the program here at the Divinity School that is called the Religion in the Arts and Contemporary Culture Program, which is sponsored by the Luce Foundation. We are pursuing a variety of different topics. I want to say one quick word about tonight's presentation that Bill asked me to say, and that is that we're expecting some explicit language. Those of you who've been reading into some of the chapter for today will already recognize that when we get to thinking about someone like Eminem, there is some explicit language and lyrics that really push hard. So if something like that is of concern to you, and Bill's going to mark when that's going to happen, you're welcome to take a bathroom break for 2 or 3 minutes and come back in. That's fine with us. But we do live in this particular culture. These are the kinds of lyrics that are all around us, and so we do want to be a community that engages what it means to be using these kinds of lyrics and these sorts of ideas. So, just stand briefly forewarned on that. A quick word about Bill. He is a 1985 graduate of the Divinity School. Is that right, Bill? Indeed.
Sadly so.
he's one of you, those of you who are students here. And he's currently on staff at the Tennessean, where he writes about music and about popular culture. Bill is also the author of 2 books. I assume you haven't written any more since I last checked, but he's prolific. The first book that I have on my list is called Heartaches by the Number, which was published by Vanderbilt University Press. And the second book is one that we've been using as one of our primary texts for our course on popular music and religious identity here. It's called I'll Take You There, Pop Music and the Urge for Transcendence, which is with Continuum Press. The Onion's AV Club named this book, I believe it was the Heartaches by the Number book, one of 17 essential books about pop music. Is that right, Bill? That was the book? Yeah. Sojourners Magazine called the latter book, quote, a definitive popular culture study for the new millennium, end of quote. Bill is a freelance writer. His work appears in publications ranging from the New York Times and the Washington Post to Rock and Rap Confidential and the Oxford American. So, and his title tonight is Something Like Sanctified, Spirituality in Contemporary Pop Music. Please make Bill Friscus Warren welcome.
Thank you, y'all. Title's kind of a misnomer for tonight. In that the chapter we're focusing on is not so sanctified. And I should probably say a little bit about the chapter, because it's something that is kind of important to my experience at the Divinity School and my ongoing relationship to it. I don't know if all of you know Ed Farley, but maybe certainly have heard of him. Was a member of the faculty, retired now. Is he teaching classes anymore?
No.
But
we've had him on campus.
He was my advisor, and I was his dropout as a doctoral student in theology after finishing my coursework. I think I was a little young at the time to be doing what I was doing, but I enjoyed it. I consulted with Ed when my agent was shopping the proposal for this book and having nibbles, but some serious, like, something is missing. And Ed's got a great pedagogical style. If it works for you, and it works for me. We had lunch together, and he had read the proposal and kind of sat there mulling and I talked too much and said nothing, and he said, I just think something is missing. And he wouldn't tell me, though, because his way is to sort of let you fumble your way to, hopefully, transcendence. And so I left being totally undone, like, I'm not going to get anywhere with this. I might as well just bag it. And then I thought more and more and kind of thought about where he comes from with his stuff, and much of his theology begins with a negative move. What we can't say, the more elusive, side of spirituality and whatnot. And that's when the idea for this middle section in my book came about, and when I wrote the proposal, immediately there was positive response. And so, still learning, 20 years on, and I dedicated the book to him because it was kind of the pop version of my dissertation that I owed him. So, and I guess what we're doing tonight is kind of counterintuitive when we think of transcendence. We think about, victory, uplift, the stuff that kind of transports us rather than the stuff that we bump up against that thwarts that experience and such. So sorry for the misnomer in the title, but it's still important and it works. What I thought I would do tonight is read a little bit from my introduction, kind of a real edited version of certain things, so we're all on the same page. I know you're reading and have read that already, but then I'm going to talk a little bit about the typology I use, the categories, and then play some music, read a short item, play some music, read a short item, and then we'll talk, probably around 7:45-ish, earlier than usual, it sounds. Does that sound okay? Okay, cool. Okay. This is the introductory part. When a lot of people think of the notion of transcendence, thoughts immediately go to otherworldly things, things having to do with divinity and such. But transcendence can take place in a lot of other ways as well. It can occur through mystical insight, through sexual intimacy, through expressions of empathy. It can be occasioned by the likes of wonder, reverence, or reciprocity. It can be achieved by standing in solidarity with others, by resisting unjust powers and conditions, or by means of historical liberation. Transcendence, I contend, takes place whenever something deeper and more abiding than the everyday breaks into and, if only fleetingly, transforms the present. Regardless, though, of how transcendence is viewed, this hunger to participate in something greater and more lasting than what we have or know, I think, is what defines us as spiritual beings. This makes spirituality not something strange or otherworldly, much less a lifestyle choice. It's not something that we can choose to participate in or not, as we do with religion. Spirituality is the stuff of who we are. It's the overriding restlessness at the core of our beings and how we respond to it. Despite being written off at times as disposable or worse, as demonic, popular recordings have long given voice to an urge for transcendence, even if the musicians who tend to make them may not be as outwardly spiritual as, say, their gospel or sectarian counterparts. Pop acts are constantly pointing beyond themselves, whether it's to a better future, to some higher ideal, or to some vision of deliverance. Heard in the right way, almost any pop record can speak to transcendental concerns. Chuck Berry's Brown-Eyed Handsome Man, a song about a gifted baseball player, served as a veiled statement of black pride amid the last gasps of Jim Crow. Aretha Franklin's Think, a lover's ultimatum issued at the height of the women's and the civil rights movements, doubled as a call for solidarity and likely served as a masked word of caution about the war in Vietnam. Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit captured the abandonment and rage felt by a generation come of age to the death rattle of AIDS on the one hand, and to a future mortgaged by Reaganomics on the other. Even records that seem nonsensical, or those that express negation, as we'll focus on some tonight, can convey an urge for transcendence and become emblems of their eras. Records that articulate this urge for transcendence are not pegged as easily as the bins of retailers might suggest. Less the domain of genres like rock, soul, or rap, they might more appropriately be termed transcendental music, music that, regardless of stylistic signature or marketing niche, points beyond itself, urging listeners to look past the mundane and to see themselves and their striving in a new light. Records of a transcendental bent, thus, are not peripheral to the history of popular music. They lie at the heart of it. The restlessness that they express often speaks to people as profoundly as what they hear in church or at their synagogue or mosque, more profoundly at times, especially lately, as many wrestle with questions of provenance in our seemingly more volatile world. In today's post-Christian milieu, a world defined increasingly by multiculturalism and globalization, pop music frequently serves as a substitute for conventional religious observance, or at least provides spiritual clarity and guidance where it might be lacking. To explore these themes and these notions, I came up with, as you all know, three major kind of subgroups of expressions of the urge for transcendence, as I call it. The first and maybe the most, the one that makes most sense, resonates immediately, are the mystics. These are folks who express their hunger for transcendence through some sort of striving for a deeper spiritual union. It may be a level of consciousness. It may be a connection to a transcendental other, God, traditional language, but other kinds of ways. The folks who kind of fall in that first category of higher states of consciousness, trying to mystically encounter God or a higher being, are the contemplatives. These are folks who tend to journey inward as they seek transcendence. I talk about Van Morrison at some length in that chapter. Jimmy Dale Gilmore, kind of a Buddhist mystic, West Texan as well. And then I don't know if they're much in play anymore, but PM Dawn, a hip-hop duo from their career throughout the 90s, but you don't find them in encyclopedias and record guides anymore, which is a real shame because it's really amazing stuff. Sensualists are another form of mystical urge for transcendence. These are folks, and this is where something like Sanctified makes some sense, and that's stealing from Marvin Gaye, folks who see sexual intimacy as a and other forms of intimacy, but interpersonal, as a portal to something more. Gaye's comment about in sexual healing about something like Sanctified is again the epitome of this. I think Madonna's career has been an expression of this this hunger as well. Some would begrudge her that, I think, because she's so popular and there's so much of the person as myth at work in who she is. But I think it's undeniably there as well. The third type of mystic and maybe the one that I think is an elevated expression of this impulse, are the empaths. These are folks who have that unique ability to enter into the experience and at their best, the suffering of others. It's something of a loaning of the self to the other. And folks like Levinas have covered this articulately and went well. That's the third in that category. The second category, the one that kind of focuses on what we're going to talk about, primarily tonight anyway, for starters, are the naysayers. These are folks who don't even have to know, and I don't intend to patronize. I don't mean to patronize. They don't necessarily even realize that their artistic expression is an urge for transcendence. On the one hand, there are the dystopians, the people who bump up against that which thwarts their experiences of transcendence, that blocks what their path to something more enduring, through their music they You know, they Rage Against the Machine. Didn't write about them here, but could have. Would have put them in the prophetic category anyway, so that's why they're kind of not there. And then the Idiots are the ones that are more in play tonight. And these are the folks for whom Raging Against the Machine isn't enough. They go a step further and seek to embody the chaos, the oppression, the discord that they experience by becoming a repository for it, and hope, and through that, perhaps transcending it, if only fleetingly. And again, I don't know that they necessarily have to be conscious of the fact that they're doing this, but I think in the case of the Idiots, they are very savvy that this is, you know, the Sex Pistols, the Johnny Rottens, the Iggy Pops, the M&Ms. There's an awareness at some level that they're doing something very unique here. And there's a time, I think, a time-honored tradition in all forms of art that for this. The final large category are the prophetic expressions of the urge for transcendence. And these tend to be expressions of that urge that show us what transcendence might look like when played out on a larger social, political, communal scale. Distinctions are artificial, but I have prophets of uplift on the one hand, people who, like Johnny Cash, The Man in Black, U2, a guy like Bono, Curtis Mayfield, who was very much someone who sang about and made music that conveyed uplift. These are folks who tend to stand with those who are oppressed. Ani DeFranco, I think, says they take the side of the good guys. They're not. They're a lot like some of the prophets in the Hebrew scriptures. They it's the solidarity that's the thing. The prophets of resistance tend to be folks who, although concerned with solidarity and embrace that, tend to focus on the structures, values, institutions that thwart transcendence for the folks that you know, these prophets of uplift stand with. So you have people sort of marching, you know, at the castle and calling oppressive structures into account, fighting the bad guys. And the final group here are what I call voices of possibility, and these are folks who go beyond solidarity and resistance, embrace both, but also are able to actually model for us what transcendence might look like. I talk a lot about Sly and the Family Stone, who I don't know what kind of currency they have these days, personal favorite of mine, but the group itself embodied in the late 60s men, women, people of various ethnic, racial backgrounds, working together, all of them in leadership, all of them in supportive roles. It was very much a communal model. Their music itself transcended boundaries. There are elements of jazz in it. There are elements of rock and roll, soul music, popular music, maybe not a whole lot of country, but anyway, they're... But that was another way in which, and then their vision as well. It was kind of writ large in certain taglines and choruses and lyrics that unfortunately have been become known more in terms of TV commercials selling cars and trucks and soda than for what they were on the radio back when I was very young. But in any case, and the other folks that I talk about at length in as voices of possibility are the girl punks. The movement was called Riot Girl in the early 90s. Groups like Bikini Kill and Slater Kinney in particular, who had a communal ethic in which they made alternative choices about entrepreneurship, about aesthetics, about ways of relating interpersonally and socially, that modeled a form of transcendence, even if it was on a somewhat microcosmic kind of scale. So, anyway, those are kind of the overarching categories, which I know that y'all are somewhat familiar with at some point. But before we listen to some music and I read a little bit more, any questions or thoughts or any of that? Rick?
What about the role of the comedian, the comical, and some of the idiot music that you referred to, I find just hilarious.
Well, that's a great question. Actually, you know, someone who doesn't have a real well-developed comedic bone in my body, it's kind of an omission, but I do think the idiots, there is some humor going on there. I mean, as offensive as Eminem can be, as in your face, and there's a smirk behind it, and there is humor there. There's a joke. Certainly Iggy Pop, you knew what he was doing, and you know, by playing the Stooge. So I think it's in there, but yeah, it's not something that I you know spend a lot of time with. But that's a whole nother.
Well,
it's very ripe.
Is what about the actual comedian such as Weird Al Yankovic?
Yeah.
What would you say about how he brings transcendence?
I'd have to maul that one. I'd have to maul that. I'm familiar with his work through my son in particular. I regret to no. Anything else for now? No. I thought we'd maybe listen to something from Iggy and the Stooges. Folks familiar with their stuff? Not so much. Yes, I don't know.
Had some up. At least the classes had some up online.
Okay, great. I mean, this is what we're hearing is this will be. This is 40 years old, so for being considered pushing boundaries, whatever it may sound a little tame, but this is. I want to be your dog.
Number one. On
yeah,
this.
Please.
Thank you.
I don't recall offhand, but that may be, I think that's John Cale from the Velvet Underground playing an electric viola.
Yeah.
They didn't have a lead guitar player, and they were so, you know, folks who know music say that, tell me the two chords only in that one. I don't know. But, you know, most.
Until the end.
Yeah, right. Well, and he was a music theorist and all that. But, yeah, they, not a lot of sophistication there. But I'm going to. Bizarre, those sleigh bell thingies. I mean, like, geez. There's a very old Sanctified Blues sermon song called Death May Be Your Santa Claus by this guy, Reverend something-something Gates. Really freaky. Always makes me think of that. Just, it's weird. When I was pulling this stuff together, I was finishing reading Joyce Carol Oates' novel Them, which I'd never read before. It was won the National Book Award in 1970, and all the action culminates. It all takes place in Detroit, but it culminates, or most of it, but it culminates in the summer of 1967 with the riots and the burning of buildings and such, which very much inform Iggy and the Stooges' music sensibility, view of the world. Very, very gripping stuff, and. Very much in keeping with the Iggy and Eminem gospel in a way. Very powerful. I thought I'm going to read just a little bit about "I Want to Be Your Dog" and Iggy, and then we're going to play something with a little bit more polish of theirs from 4 or 5 years later, produced by David Bowie with a lead guitar player. I'm not sure if it's here are just a couple of paragraphs from what you've just read. "I Want to Be Your Dog," the Stooges' thudding monument to lubricity and self-loathing, is at once a proposition and a statement of purpose. Over a ramrod beat lifted from the Velvet Underground's I'm Waiting for the Man, Iggy Stooge, not yet Pop, invites the subject of his lust over to his place to have sex with him. Iggy's is a crude come-on, yet in the end it is more self-abasing and more complex than those of other lurid 60s fantasies like Midnight Rambler, Rolling Stones, and 96 Tears, and the Mysterians. Unlike the protagonists of those records, who tend to be more of the stalker, rapist variety, Iggy is not exactly being a sexual predator here. If anything, the song's title suggests that he wants to submit to the whims of the person that he's fantasizing about. A whole other way of hearing the song is that it's about shooting heroin. And I'm sure there are multiple interpretations, but this is mine. "I'm so messed up, I want you here. In my room, I want you here," he grunts to the implacable thrusting of the rhythm section and to what sounds rather incongruously like sleigh bells. "And now I want to be your dog. And now I want to be your dog," he glowers, repeating the line one more time before barking, "Well, come on." Iggy's ham-fisted proposition might seem clear enough. Less obvious, perhaps, is the way that it serves as that statement of purpose. Like so much of the Stooges' brutish, putatively mindless music, "I Want to Be Your Dog" reflects the group's desire not just to evoke the blue-collar tedium and alienation that they knew, but to move beyond evocation to embody those conditions and the revulsion that they breed. Thus we have Iggy mugging as a stooge and a dog and generally playing the idiot, yet not mainly to gain attention or to achieve catharsis. Iggy acts the fool as a way of confronting the degradation that surrounds him in hopes of divesting it of its power, and, if not annihilating it, then at least prevailing over it by proving that he can survive it. "I am the world's forgotten boy, the one who's searching to destroy," he snarls in "Search and Destroy," propounding his misfit cum violator ethic amid a firestorm of metallic guitar. On the track that follows it, on Raw Power, he urges, "Give me danger, little stranger, and I'll feel your disease. There's nothing in my dreams, just some ugly memories." Much as he is in "I Want to Be Your Dog," Iggy is on the prowl and bound for the gutter here. He is opening himself to infection and harm in hopes of becoming immune to them, and by means of that resistance, transcending them. The mayhem that the Stooges personified is on the face of things more profane than anything else. At a more fundamental level, though, it testifies to a desire, a hunger that, while fueled by negation, though not its sometimes look-alike nihilism, is spiritual or transcendental in nature. The Stooges carry a strong element of sickness in their music, a crazed, quaking uncertainty, an errant foolishness that effectively mirrors the absurdity and desperation of the times, wrote Lester Bangs in the unforgettable piece that he did on the band for Cream magazine in 1970. But I believe that they also carry a strong element of cure, he said, a post-derangement sanity. We can hear track number 3, which is Search and Destroy. Kind of fold some of that in there as well.
Cheetah with a hat full of napalm. I'm a runaway son of a nuclear A-bomb. I am the world's forgotten boy, the one who searches and destroys. In the dead of night, love in the middle of a firefight.
Somebody got to save my soul. It sounds probably pretty tame, you know, by a lot of standards. I think it could have been from the Beatles' White Album or something, you know. But Helter Skelter might have been more scary. But and it's, you know, it's in context, it had a lot of heft. What I'd like to do is read one more passage. This is from the M&M section, and then we'll play one of the tracks from one of his records. And as John said, it's pretty transgressive in some ways. I mean, everyone's heard it, but if you don't want to hear it, you know, like a bathroom break could be good. But yeah, it's too often in hip-hop, rage, especially against women, is a mere convention, wrote the critic Robert Christgau. This continues to be his words. It's unexamined and thus brutal. When Eminem rhymes about raping his mother and murdering his wife, it's not. Eminem unpacks rage and the conventionalizing of rage. He's deeply frightening, yet at the same time, devastatingly funny. Does every one of his 7 million fans understand that he's representing rather than advocating? Of course not. But the percentage that doesn't is lower by a factor of 100 than the percentage of pundits who never listen to hip-hop yet assume Eminem is destroying America's moral fiber. That's the end of the Criscow. Eminem, in other words, does not want to kill anyone. More than anything, he wants to get inside people's heads and, from misogyny to self-loathing, to eradicate the dis-ease that has taken root there, or at least to alert people to the dangers of it. When on the chorus of Kill You, his crew sings, "You don't want to fuck with Shady because Shady will fuck with you," they are not just warning listeners to steer clear of the ruinous Slim Shady, articulating something akin to the doctrine of original sin. They also are referring to the sickness and shadiness that lies within the conflicted psyches of all people, and to how, if this contagion is not approached with caution, it can get the better of a person and those around them. My name is Marshall Mathers. I'm an alcoholic. I have a disease, and they don't know what to call it, Eminem declares in Just Don't Give A. Others might not know how to identify what ails him, but Eminem has a name for it, Slim Shady, the alter ego that he assumes in order to confront and build up his immunity to it, much as Iggy turned sickness into strength with his stooge persona, and in that way transcended it. To be sure, Eminem's vision of what might enable him to get over or rise above his circumstances consists mostly of the banal likes of fame and fortune. Yet it also hinges on gaining respect, on having, as he rhymes in My Name Is, an ass big enough for the world to kiss. No less than that of any sharecropping hillbilly or blues singer, or even a punk like Iggy who grew up in as asphyxiating a part of Greater Detroit as Mathers did, Eminem's music expresses a fierce urge to transcend the humiliation that he's known. Witness If I Had A, where over a sleek gangsta bump, Eminem spits a litany of soul-sucking things that he, as Marshall Mathers, is tired of. The list includes everything from pumping gas for $5.50 an hour and not being able to afford a telephone to, quote, committing too many sins and, quote, not being able to get to sleep without taking a Tylenol PM. It all adds up to being sick of being white trash and always poor, as he says, and of being tired of living with a guilty conscience, all of which were hallmarks of Eminem's nomadic trailer park childhood with his drug-addicted mother, who herself is a survivor of abuse. Eminem was still living that degrading, peripatetic life in 1999, the year that he released the Slim Shady LP, his multi-platinum breakthrough album. "Free Slim Shady" trumpets the cartoon at the center of the booklet that accompanies the CD, calling not just for the liberation of Eminem, slash Marshall Mathers, from the prison-like trailer park, or trailer depicted in the comic. It also expresses Eminem's need to break free of Shady, the misfit monster, likened in the track Brain Damage to Frankenstein, to which that squalor gave birth. Eminem's raging desire to overcome and ultimately annihilate his past is the reason why he raps, once again figuratively, about killing his mother, his now ex-wife, and even himself. "Well, since age 12, I felt like I'm someone else, because I hung my original self from the top bunk with the belt," he rhymes to the head-bopping lurch of My Name Is. Even the name of the company under which Eminem conducts his business, Aftermath Entertainment, conveys this impulse, his will to raise the world that he's known and everything in it, and yet also survive the aftermath of that destruction. And this is the offending track, potentially.
All right. Number six. This is If I Had A...
Marshall Mathers. What is life? Life is like a big obstacle in front of
obstacles. I'm done. thoughts, responses, questions, concerns?
I had, particularly with regard to Eminem, but others, I guess within the hip-hop genre, but more broadly as well, you could use Rob Zombie as an example. Something equally disturbing, I guess. But my question is, basically, isn't our desire to call this transcendence merely an attempt to appropriate the goings-on or to kind of square with our own psyche, mm-hmm. the fact that Eminem really wants to kill his wife when he's saying mm-hmm. that. Like, that's not mm-hmm. a metaphor. That's doesn't that really reflect, like, in calling, like, the music of Eminem or other hip-hoppers or, like, Rob Zombie or something, in calling, and I'm not saying you're calling, like, Zombie, I'm just, mm-hmm. in general, like, isn't that really a reflection of our own fear that he might quit being mad at his ex-wife and come after us? It appears to be just a situation of trying to appropriate the absurd, but the problem is that the reality is absurd. Like Eminem in the song where he saw Just the Two of Us. That is a twisted song, and I don't know if everyone else is familiar with it, but I mean, he and his daughter having like a little like lollipop love song about like the murder of his ex-wife, and as much as it may be sensationalized in an attempt to make money, dude is angry,
and no denying it.
My question is, how do we navigate the troublesome aspects of trying to call something like that an attempt at transcendence when I don't know.
Yeah, great question. Very angry, disturbing, twisted, et cetera. My way into that is through seeking understanding, and that's kind of what the project here was. I don't know that I could say that with any. I couldn't say it about anyone, perhaps, but certainly not on the recorded evidence that Eminem is consciously seeking a form of transcendence that would work for me. But I hear in that anger, in that twistedness, in that profound, profound brokenness, a hunger for something more, something better, even if, as I read in the passage, what he sees as those things is fairly superficial and will be disappointing, but that, you know, for many of us that have capacities for reflection, they would be disappointing, anytime you're dealing with something transgressive, it's dangerous, and it's meant to be, and it can't be taken lightly. So, I mean, I hear your concerns.
It raises some questions in terms of the work we're doing, trying to analyze these artists. Just trying to wade in on this
logically,
because what I think Bill's trying to do is a kind of text-based analysis, sure. really kind of focus on what's there, and to lift that.
Definitely.
It could be imagined in a million contexts. I mean, now you could go out and do a kind of fandom project where you interview the fans of someone like and come up with a, I would think, a different set of understandings as well about the effect of his music, mm-hmm. some of which might be a kind of dystopian transcendence, and others would be just, I'm just appropriating all these values in a very negative mm-hmm. way and so on.
Yeah.
Or you could do a kind of author analysis and sit down with him for hours and on end and try to really get psychoanalytically at what the heck's happening, what's he doing. But to some extent, I think what I hear Bill trying to do in this book, with some authorial you know, some contextualization of the author's
sure.
life.
Oh, definitely.
But not with in-depth, ongoing interviews
no.
with him to try to get at, given that what we know about the context and the text, then to try to bring some kind of, and to place him within a tradition of artists that have similar, that seem to be doing similar kinds of things.
And in a theological and philosophical tradition as well.
Right.
I'm interested, do I like Eminem? No. Do I think he is gifted? Absolutely. Intelligent? Absolutely. Has he made some great popular recordings? Absolutely. All the things, though, your concerns? Absolutely. My project is one that doesn't necessarily engage part of what you wanted to talk about. I'm interested in locating what I see as the urge for transcendence expressed in popular music and trying to understand it. And it's a very different thing from endorsing or, I don't know if you all haven't read the U2 section yet, but I have major, major issues with the global significance of what Bono does, deleterious stuff that I think is causing great havoc and oppression around the world. And he's a hero, you know, so it doesn't come through necessarily in the discussion. There's some, tension there. But anyway, but I'm not endorsing people, although obviously some people you can tell that I adore, but, from how they're treated. But still, I don't know if that helps, but, yeah.
I think that's one of the struggles, for theology in general, is that, at some point we're working from the presupposition that, universally speaking, people care about. I mean, it's the same thing that people rub up against with Tillich or a theologian like that, where, your postmodern pushback to someone like a Tillich is, who knows if people care about this crap? You care, so you're superimposing this. So there's a bit of a leap of faith in assuming, and I mean, I'm pretty comfortable with that leap, but I understand the postmodern critique that maybe Eminem just likes to kind of bitch and kvetch.
I would argue that just the need to be getting something out in the public forum is an expression of the urge for transcendence. It's trying to get beyond. It's trying, it's a communal reaching, whether it's wanting to annihilate community, it can be a broken expression, and I think his is often that, of that urge, but it betrays it in his case, perhaps, that urge is there. I just think it's something that's stitched into the fabric of our being. It's an Augustinian argument. I mean, it's old school, extremely, my book.
I'm totally on board with you that there is an urge for transcendence in what he's doing. It seems very cathartic, maybe not sufficiently, but he's trying to. But do you think, where do we have a place to make a value judgment on how good of a catharsis it is, is it even healthy? I mean, obviously we're all disturbed by what he's doing.
When do we call him into account?
Yeah,
no, that's, the prophetic, the next section kind of is about not necessarily taking an individual case like this, although a very socially relevant case, but that's the kind of thing that the final major section of the book talks about. Again, not maybe necessarily censoring or whatever, him, but yeah. It's really broken. It's really fucked up. what's going on here? There's just no denying that.
It seems like, just in terms of a sort of hermeneutic model, if you decide in your interpretive work, as Bill did, that in fact negation is a way in which people seek somehow to transcend and to move beyond their own experience, then it makes some sense to me that you would look for the most broken negative. And I think it does beg the question of value judgments in terms of how one works. I think you're absolutely right. But I do think... And I'm going back to the Stooges in my generation, who were, they sound tame in this context. But in my generation, you know, just banging off the walls to the Stooges or to the Sex Pistols. That was considered. I mean, you were going. You were in hell, not just. You were literally as far as the folks. And there were huge value judgments around sort of an anarchist mindset. And all that.
You know, what was really interesting for me reading the Oates's book, Them, which, you know, the title, Them is lowercase, and I'm probably telling you things you already know because you probably all have read it, but repeatedly in that book, the marginal people in her book, white, black, male, female, victims, offender, you know, just, she kept hammering the point, if you haven't been there, you don't get it. You know, you just can't understand this stuff. You know, you don't know what's going on there. You can bring bourgeois sensibilities, you know, lofty moral values, some really enriched nurture to it, but this is speaking and it's telling us something and we need to listen to it. That's, you know, there's no uplift in what she's got going there, and It's a slap in the face, but it's real, and I think it speaks to kind of why other nations hate us too. I mean, our lack of an ability to enter into things that are different and don't quite, you know. Anyway,
it just strikes me as interesting the things that we find offensive.
Yeah.
And that why, I mean, you have to say if you're offended, get up. You know, by the song, get up and go to the bathroom. But really, to me, where we should be offended is the system, the put Eminem there in the first place. To me, that gets at justice, and to me, that gets at what we should truly be offended about. And so, whenever everyone was raging about, you know, this value stuff about Eminem, I'm going, we're missing the point here, you know. And so that, and then I'm just curious because I have a theory about this, but
mm-hmm.
Are there any women that speak
like
this? Because I would maybe argue that when women, if women or woman, whoever, were to really speak in such a way, it would be seen as completely different, completely othered. Not that Eminem, there was an outrage around Eminem, but I just think that there would be a disparity there.
Yeah. Well, great. Actually, I wanted to talk about the latter point. Blame me for the commercial about the toilet. I was at the Divinity School when there was Enric was here at the same time, a really heightened awareness, concern about the way therapeutic issues and issues of art and theology came into play, and could not have played the Eminem in a public thing without probably getting taken out and thrown in the trash. You know, it would have been that just, you know, and I know that's 20 years plus, but I just checked in with John about that and just as a courtesy because, I totally can relate to you. I mean, anyway, and there are so many social examples we could use and, you know, politicians and transgressions, what should really be the transgression. But as far as do we have any idiots, women, or at least naysayers? Courtney Love and Hole nearly made this chapter. Thought a lot about it, spent a lot of time with it, really liked much of her work. Just didn't think that kind of the, you know, her embodying the, you know, the negative appropriation of, you know, doll parts, whatnot, quite worked as something this transgressive. It was just too, she was frankly just too righteous, I thought, in her anger. Not that these people, especially like an Iggy or the Sex Pistols, haven't been righteous. But anyway, and then the other person who was a good one, who's a real favorite of mine, is PJ Harvey, but I really think she needed to go where she went with the sensualists. It's footnoted in there, but if anybody likes her music or is interested, there was an amazing essay written by Ann Powers, who's one of the finest music critics of the past two generations. She currently writes for the Daily, the LA Times, but called Houses of the Holy. And she looked at one of Harvey's early albums in terms of Teresa of Avila and a lot of other female medieval female mystics who went through bodily transformations or reported them, major bodily transformations, like P.J. Harvey is a 50-foot woman in one of her songs, that kind of thing, in terms of their expression of their encounter of the divine. It's just really powerful. But she needed to go there. But she could easily, as that 50-foot conqueror, work really well chopping some stuff up. So great question, though.
Well, I think of MIA and Tori Amos certainly on that. Soundgarden interview on NPR, they were breaking up, and I was somewhat familiar with Soundgarden. But one of the guys, talking about the legacy of the band, said, we're not always sure what we've done, what we did, but our music, we're told, made people feel strong. And we're glad about that. And that sort of closed the door on Soundgarden. And I think of this here in the question, will we receive his witness as a kind of testimony? And the question we have to bring to it is it true?
Yeah.
Is it truthful? Mm-hmm. And, I wrote down the phrase time-honored tradition because there is one in this kind of, saying what we feel, not what we ought to say. And that I think it liberates in a therapeutic way. I mean, anyone who's gone through really deep counseling, there's a kind of role-playing where it isn't exactly, you're not talking to this person who abused you, but you might even have someone play the role. And it's it can redeem in the sense that it re-evaluates your own thing. And when he says something like, there's a million people out there, like me, I don't think of that as a self-justifying statement on the part of Eminem so much as we are legion and this is what we're going through kind of thing.
Yeah. No.
Yeah. I wonder if there were questions about other, this was one chapter that you focused on, but we've been reading other chapters as well.
And one thing just to say about this middle section, it is counterintuitive when talking about transcendence to think about people destroying things. You know, that it's about furthering brokenness in the as something that comes out of the experience of brokenness or thwarted transcendence. So anyway, but yeah.
Well, one other thing that really struck me about this in terms of, sorry, my phone is blowing up, but one other thing that actually I wanted to say about this particular section, we've been reading Cobb's book, Helton Cobb's book, about the Gothic. There's one of the, he has a section there on the Gothic, and there's a sense in which underneath the sort of Gothic music, he argues that there is a kind of nihilism there. There's not as much of an attempt, in other words, to work through to the other side. There may be some kind of transcendence, I would imagine, in simply accepting that you're a victim in the world and just overwhelmed, and you're just pissed at it. But what I was hearing you say in this with respect to Eminem and these artists is that they actually, that there is some attempt to actually go through to the other side. In other words, try to push through, not just sort of accept a kind of nihilistic world. I'm not saying that any kind of moral universe appears.
Right. No. Yeah, that's good.
I think it actually does have that sort of negation piece here. And it may have been you who were also talking about the difference between these kinds of things.
Yeah, and early in this chapter, I'm finding the page, but not the passage, and it's something that I invoke. It's not something that I invented. But the distinction between nihilism being something that is private versus public or political.
Right.
Folks expressing these incredibly negative, broken, whatnot things who feel the urge, the need to do it publicly, there's some reaching to connect somehow there. There's if you're a nihilist, there's no reason to do that. It's just not worth going the political step. You're screwed. It's beyond hope. That would be a counter. That move makes no sense. So,
yeah.
but there's some smart person who says it in there. In the footnote.
Other questions from him?
Yeah.
I'm intrigued by your kind of discussion about artists like Iggy Pop were seeking to literally embody the destructive, humiliating forces of life. And it made me think of like Lenny Bruce and Richard Pryor. And
totally.
I don't know if that's a stretch, but that's
Mm-mm.
sort of like,
nope.
well...
Mm-mm. No,
I'm just
I don't think so at all.
You know, Richard Pryor sort of, well, I'll drop the N-bomb 75 yeah. times a day.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
mine.
Actually, I think where it's even more pronounced, and I'm not as conversant, back when I TA'd for Charles Hamburg in the World Religions course, I was better at this, but I knew a little bit more. But a lot of indigenous traditions have holy figures, you know, shaman-type people who actually do become a repository for
Absolutely.
The brokenness and all that. And I think that's what these people are doing without the sense of vocation that we you know would see as higher theological, moral, whatever. It's just what seems to be going on there, whether, again, they're aware of it or doing it or not. But, I mean, Iggy, I think he's a really smart guy. And, you know, when he... would you know wipe peanut butter all over himself and jump out in the audience and tell people to lick it off. He knew what he was doing, you know, and rolling in the glass, the broken glass, just, you know, it's, you know, it's not just entertainment. Yet there's something going on there. He apparently has an immensely high IQ, just as a sidebar, but that doesn't necessarily translate into visionary art. So
well, I have a quick follow-up to that. I would be interested to know if people like Iggy ever reflected on the feedback they got over time from fans, because I would imagine that would evoke this sort of messianic worship that probably a lot of fans wouldn't even be able to articulate. It's sort of like, thank you for doing this, but I'm not sure what I'm thanking you for.
You know, in terms of biography, he kind of crashed about the time of the last thing we heard, their second treatment for heroin, and became sort of a recovery poster child. About the time that I don't know if you all hear that commercial. It's for one of the cruise lines. It's his lust for life.
Yeah.
It's just amazing. It's just something that, what it was in its day and now, you know, all that business. But so he's been no toxins in the body. You know, he has less body fat than Michael Phelps, apparently. You know, so he's just an amazing physical health specimen. But because he literally nearly killed himself, so took it too far almost.
This type of music, how much, for it being heard on the radio, it seems to me it would depend on the leniency of the FCC.
Oh, yeah, I mean, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the Eminem stuff, that's all... You know, just the clean, what is it called? Clean version, you know, kind of thing. You bleep,
right.
Yeah, it's spiced, yeah. And radio likes uplift, so you wouldn't have, you know, we didn't hear I Want to Be Your Dog on the radio, even though it's really popular and, you know, or has an enduring popularity among, you know, lots of people. But, so.
There are preachers who take on this embodying of the disease, the shamanistic. Sojourner Truth, her Ain't I a Woman sermon is a great
Beautiful.
Example of that. Theoda Smith has a great study of her and others who actually incorporate conjuring and shamanistic elements into their preaching within the African American tradition, and there are other traditions.
Yeah.
That's true.
So
it's there in the sort of oracular tradition of homiletics, where you go to the oracle.
Good one. Thank you. So.
Other questions?
Well, the shot that brings to mind, the 8 Mile, I don't know what the name of the song is, but you don't have an ethic like you should or you ought to, but you do have in the chorus of that one, you've got to lose yourself in the music, you better own it, kind of thing. Would you view that not, you know, but you mentioned vocation.
Yeah.
Might that be a, that, I mean, because it's always God still.
Yeah.
Always returning to that therapy, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, I almost brought along a different, another CD to play another track, Who I Am, I think it's called, where he kind of goes into, you know, engages all these questions about what am I doing, you know, am I, you know, but I didn't bring that along, but it kind of, it shows a level of reflection that's much greater than one would think given just this, you know, given what appears to be in.
Your stuff on Sinead O'Connor too, this sense of this is the way, and not just transcendent, spiritualizing it, but it is a way out of this situation, music,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
there's no other door.
Yeah, well, that would be a subtext for the whole, you know, the deal. I mean, the number of people in here who have pretty profound therapeutic issues, who've made amazing art. It's kind of, you know, where what that intersection. It's not my. Haven't spent a lot of time going deeper on that. But there's a, you know, there's a lot there. Gosh, yeah.
Well, Bill, it's a wonderful book, and we've really enjoyed it. And thanks a lot for coming
not
and
at
talking
all.
To us nice further to about it tonight. We'll let you go. The air conditioning is gone in this building. Appreciate it. We'll next week we do not have a session on Tuesday, but on Thursday night we've got an interesting session coming up. So watch the we've got Rawls coming, Dave.
It's the human condition,
right? It's the human condition. Is if we haven't engaged it a little bit tonight.
Yeah, we have Steve Mason and Charlie Lowell from Jars of Clay. Who is your person?
Brian Ritchie.
Brian Ritchie.
Julie Lee has backed out on me. Sorry to say. But I have a few people who are significant who will.
Great. Can we make it some performances going?
Yes, I have no doubt.
Excellent. Yeah. All right, good. That'll be wonderful. All right, thank you.
Thanks.
We're a week from this. A lot of ways we should be teaching the course. We get this
question. Sure. No, earlier. So I